Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Melissa Zimmerman, Vice President of Clinical Services for Jewish Family and Children's Services, discussing the need for counseling during the pandemic. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. While the pandemic continues to sicken and kill many people, hope is beginning to spring forth. Vaccination of the entire population of the nation of Israel will be completed by late March, before Passover. While here in the United States, President Biden announced this past week that we should have adequate vaccine to inoculate the entire age-eligible population by July. It's definitely nice to finally hear some good news on the COVID-19 front, and it comes at a hopeful time of year for Jews, the season of Purim and Passover, the end of winter and the beginning of spring. Purim celebrates the events of the Book of Esther in the Bible, of course, the salvation of the Jews from attempted destruction, first, but certainly not the last time that happened. The Jews are saved, the bad guys, especially Haman, are destroyed, and we drink and eat to celebrate, and everybody has a good time. If you remember, Purim was the last time that 2020 seemed like it might be a normal year. We had bar mitzvahs and weddings in public last February and well into March, and we celebrated the Feast of Esther with all the normal revelry, more or less. Purim this year falls on the evening of February 25th, that's a Thursday night, and the day of February 26th. But last year it was in March, and my own congregation had a raucous, mildly alcohol-influenced Megillah reading, as is customary, ate lots of delicious hamantaschen of all kinds, and then held our very first Purim carnival. We had heard about coronavirus, of course, but we weren't yet overly concerned about it. In fact, I'm afraid to admit that my costume last Purim was rubber gloves, a mask, and a Corona beer t-shirt. Get it? Coronavirus. Which at the time seemed like just the sardonic tone to strike for that wild and crazy holiday. After all, on Purim, people dress up like the wicked villain Haman or any other costume they choose. I remember Purims where kids and adults dressed up like Saddam Hussein or Yasser Arafat or Richard Nixon, so coronavirus kind of fit that mode of satire. Anyway, last Purim was as normal as that wild festival can be. And then, just after Purim, as we prepared for big Passover Seders, the world shut down. Assemblies of over 10 people were verboten, stores ran out of toilet paper, ICUs were overwhelmed, and religion moved on to Zoom and Facebook. It says something that Purim was the last normal time of the Jewish calendar year 5780. Purim was normal. And we are now approaching a full Jewish year of something nowhere near normal. In fact, my own synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, has been the only one to consistently offer in-person services in southern Arizona, albeit with very limited attendance, mask wearing, and social distancing, and of course no Oneg Shabbats or Kiddushes to share. We might well be the only congregation in the state of Arizona to have blended services, some people live, some online on Facebook Live, and we are one of the very few in the nation of the progressive sort. We are very careful, of course, and we are also particularly grateful that, thank God, nobody has contracted COVID-19 in our congregation from attending services or classes. But as I mentioned, After an incredibly challenging year, the green shoots of hope are beginning to poke through the bleakness of this pandemic period. We don't expect to reopen synagogues more broadly in the Jewish world for this Purim, or even for Pesach, to be honest. At least, not the way we normally would. But we can see some light at the end of the tunnel. I don't think even Shavuot in May will be back to normal for Jews, but it sure looks to me like we'll be able to have High Holy Day services in person this year, even if many of us will be wearing masks, and probably all of us. The Hebrew word for hope is tikvah, the same word that's in the national anthem of Israel, HaTikvah. And hope is a powerful and beautiful thing, a gift from God that can sustain us and bring us from isolation to community and from sadness to joy. We could all use some of that hopeful spirit now, can't we? Our play out this morning, kind of on that theme, comes from Eden Elaine, who will make history during Eurovision 2021 as Israel's first Ethiopian representative at the Global Pop Song Contest. Her song, Set Me Free, is mostly sung in English, except for one Hebrew phrase in the chorus, Chalas im Hashigaon, which translates to Enough with the Madness. Indeed. Aline, who is 20, was born in Jerusalem to Jewish parents who immigrated from Ethiopia. She was raised in a religiously observant home, attended Jewish schools, and has fulfilled her army commitment. Last year, she won on Kochav Nolad, The Next Star. The Israeli show's winning contestant from that emerges as the country's representative in Eurovision. That global competition was canceled last year amid the coronavirus pandemic, but it will happen this year in the Netherlands in May. Israel's Netta won the Eurovision contest in 2018, you may remember, for the song Toy. She earned Israel the right to host the competition in 2019. That was the country's first Eurovision win in decades, and, well, we hope this one does well.
Take a look what we've become, it's been so long. Getting you out of my life, I feel so strong. Set me free, feel my beating heart in perfect harmony. Don't let me down. Feeling like a prison, looking for the reason. I don't wanna say goodbye. Feels like no tomorrow. Just fine.
That was Edenaleen, Israel's entry in the Eurovision contest for 2021, singing Set Me Free. That'll be coming up this May. When we return on To Jewish in just a moment, our guest, Melissa Zimmerman, the Vice President of Clinical Services at Jewish Family and Children's Services, will explore just how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted our need for counseling and how that's been addressed. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone in the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance of the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsoros, a small group joins in person every Friday night and Saturday morning. Just email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or come every Friday night to our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We'll hold services with full music by Virtual Experience Weekly, as well as our in-person, masked, and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access those by emailing us, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Many of the classes, as well as our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, are available in blended formats as well. Some students live and some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, also taught on Zoom and in blended format, and of course all of our services on Facebook Live or in person, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years.
We are delighted to welcome to To Jewish our guest this morning. Melissa Zimmerman is the Vice President of Clinical Services at Jewish Family and Children's Services of Southern Arizona. She was named Top 40 Under 40 by the local newspaper here, and has done wonderful work and continues to do so during an interesting and, I would say, challenging time. Good morning and welcome to To Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Rabbi.
So explain what the Vice President of Clinical Services does in a broader sense at Jewish Family and Children's Services.
Sure. My role is really to oversee all of our behavioral health services. So we have outpatient counseling services, an in-home program through the Department of Child Safety. And my role is to really ensure that we're using evidence-based practice, all of the programs are running smoothly, and that we can continue to serve at-risk populations the best we can.
So this is a very complicated time. I don't think you're doing any in-person counseling. It's telehealth now, right?
Correct.
How is that? How is that differ? What are the challenges associated with that?
You know, I expected it to be more challenging than it is, actually. Once we kind of got into it, we noticed that it's very, very similar to in-person services, especially when you're using the video component. So we use Zoom as our platform. We found it to be very effective. And some of the barriers that were keeping people from therapy, such as transportation, childcare, have actually been eliminated by telehealth. So we have several clients, I'd say the majority, who say they actually prefer telehealth as opposed to in-person. However, there are definitely disadvantages as well. I think the biggest thing is just our crisis response. You know, it's one thing to be in the room with someone when they're having a crisis.
Sure.
And they need that, you know, immediate attention versus seeing them through the screen and needing to guide them through something over the screen or call a different response system to go reach out to them.
Are people less likely to respond to counseling in an emergency situation, a crisis situation, as you say, if they're online instead of in person?
No, not really. We've seen the same type of response to intervention. It's just there's those rare cases that someone really needs someone in person to maintain safety, you know, and there's these different factors that are not in our control when someone's working from their home, when they're doing therapy from their home environment that we don't have to deal with in the office. So as far as, you know, making sure it's a safe environment, that there's no type of weapon that they can access, you know, those types of things, we've really had to be creative and come up with different plans and, you know, make sure that the clients are on the same page with us as far as, you know, who else can we contact if we can't get there. So that's been challenging. But overall, I think the positive effects have outweighed the negative. We've really seen a decrease in cancellations and no-shows, which tells me that people are getting the service, you know, more effectively. They're able to get to their service, they're able to access it without having to deal with some of those barriers that keep many people from getting therapy.
We will talk much more with Melissa Zimmerman of Jewish Family and Children's Services about offering services during the pandemic when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, with over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the role of Jews in the Foreign Service, we're talking about, like, Jewish ambassadors. If you had an Orthodox Jew who was an ambassador, which does, of course, occur. You know, the complications and the additional responsibilities or the additional balancing act that's required. But in doing that, one of the things that came up is I don't really know what an ambassador does on a daily basis. You know, we see these people appointed to these important ambassadorships, the ambassador to Israel, the ambassador to the Court of St. James, the ambassador to France. I don't really know what an ambassador does.
Well, you're in good company, Rabbi, because most people don't have a clue. And what an ambassador does is not actually all that different from what his or her immediate subordinates do. And the challenge of being an Orthodox Jew in the environment of the Foreign Service is just as great for everyone, whether you're an ambassador or not. If you're an ambassador, you have more clout and you can insist that the government provide you with extra plates and glassware, but that's a very small part of the job. I think most people, when they think of what does an ambassador do, they think that he or she goes out to diplomatic receptions and cocktails and hosts events at home, and it's all a ceremonial function.
Right. Wearing a, you know, tuxedo or
which
fancy
is not
dress
at all
something.
The case. I mean, I went through an entire career in the Foreign Service without ever buying a black tie.
Wow.
I never wore one. My career went just fine, thank you. But one of the reasons that career Foreign Service officers get so upset when a non-career person is appointed to an ambassadorship is that that somehow presupposes that being an ambassador just comes naturally and it's something you can just step into without extensive training, which is absolutely not true. I mean, you need 20 or 30 years in the Foreign Service before you're truly ready to be an ambassador. And that's because the ambassador has to oversee every function of the embassy, and not only the State Department component of the embassy, but all the other agencies of the U.S. government who are there. Treasury, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Commerce, whatever. All the military branches. I mean, many embassies have a defense attaché overall, an Air Force attaché, a Navy attaché, an Army attaché, and countless others. And most people who are, let's say, house painters in Alabama, no matter how wealthy they are, how successful they are at that job, don't have much of an idea of what these agencies even are, what they do, how to supervise them effectively, how to harness their energies to get people working together in tandem to accomplish national security objectives, or even what is a national security objective. That's not entirely clear to political appointee ambassadors. It is to career people, because they have helped formulate those objectives over the years. So what are some of the things that an embassy does? Well, first of all, there's the upkeep of the building itself, getting a paint job, fixing the plumbing, all that. Now, most of that doesn't involve the ambassador, but you have to be aware that somebody's doing that, and you have to make sure that there's no corruption in the bidding, there's not any kind of insider job, because it reflects very poorly on you as an ambassador if even an embassy function that seems minor, like contracting a painter, is done in a corrupt or a manner that's less than transparent. We value transparency, accountability, and all that, and we should do that in all that we do. Then there's any number of other functions. There's shipping your household effects overseas. There's payroll. There's all these administrative things that are required for an embassy to work smoothly. And the only person who really oversees it all is nominally the ambassador, which really only works if he or she is a career Foreign Service officer, or the number two in the embassy, the deputy chief of mission, known to us insiders as the DCM. That person really does have to know everything and have a finger in everything, because he or she, the moment the ambassador leaves the country, whether it's for vacation or to go get a haircut or for consultations in Washington or whatever, that person is in charge of the embassy. So that person really has to keep their finger on the pulse.
De facto ambassador at that point. Yeah.
Right.
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 Well, Tom, it's fascinating. Thanks so much for that view inside all of our embassies. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Ah, yes, the old man said, I remember the good old days back in Brooklyn during the Depression, when my mama would send me food shopping with a single dollar bill, your Bubby. I'd bring back 5 pounds of potatoes, a carton of milk, 2 pounds of bread, a piece of cheese, and a dozen eggs. Alas, those days are long gone. There are too many security cameras now. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and be careful of those security cameras. And now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah that's at the heart of Jewish religious experience today, our portion of Truma this week has God commanding the Israelites, Asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham, make me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and the directions for building the Ark of the Covenant are explained in detail. To create a new central shrine for prayer, the place which God's presence will actually inhabit, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, which comes to be called a truma offering. And a remarkable thing happens. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build the holy structures needed to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required. Moses actually has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first time in history when a temple building campaign brought in more than was asked for or required. May it happen soon to my congregation. The word for this experience, anyway, is truma, a freewill offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of the heart. This generous offering is a powerful thing indeed, for when it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from this free generosity, is filled immediately with the Shekhinah, God's presence. When we give freely of ourselves to our own temples today, in time, love, care, or money, we seek to recreate that freewill offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too can bring God's presence and God's love into our own lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book, Open, Closed, Open. I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fever. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stay together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color, and we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as they pass, as we pass. May we find love of God and holiness and connection in our own sanctuaries today and always. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Melissa Zimmerman, Vice President of Clinical Services at Jewish Family and Children's Services, will explain how Jewish values are reflected in their organization's work, as well as how the pandemic impacts counseling and mental health. Find out all about it when we come back on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Director Steven Spielberg has been awarded the 2021 Genesis Prize, the award nicknamed the Jewish Nobel. The award, which honors extraordinary individuals for their outstanding professional achievement, contribution to humanity, and commitment to Jewish values, was announced last week. Key Jewish themes are often woven into Spielberg's narratives: importance of identity and belonging, maintaining humanity in a ruthless world, caring for the other, and honoring the moral obligation to do the right thing, the Genesis Prize Foundation said about the Oscar winner. The foundation also said it is honoring his extraordinary work to preserve the memory of the Holocaust and prevent future genocides through film, public advocacy, and philanthropy. Spielberg, of course, is founder of the USC Shoah Foundation, which preserves Holocaust survivor testimonies and which he created in the wake of the acclaim for his 1993 Holocaust film, Schindler's List. In contrast to past years, the foundation considered votes on the winner from people all around the world. While the prize committee had the ultimate discretion about the selection of the recipient of this prestigious award, the fact Spielberg received the most votes was a major determining factor, they said. This honor comes with a $1 million prize. Past recipients, including Michael Douglas, Michael Bloomberg, Natalie Portman, and Natan Sharansky, have donated their winnings to philanthropic causes. Launched in 2013 by a group of Russian Jewish philanthropists, including current foundation chairman Stan Polovets, the prize is financed through a permanent endowment of $100 million established by the Genesis Prize Foundation. In other news, Herschel Shanks, one-time publisher and editor of Moment magazine and a powerhouse in the popularization of biblical archaeology as the creator of BAR, Biblical Archaeology Magazine, has died at the age of 90 from COVID-19. An attorney by training, in 1975, Shanks started BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review, a Washington-based magazine reaching more than 250,000 subscribers at its peak in the early 2000s, including longtime subscriber Rabbi Sam Kohan, by the way. The magazine took scholarly works on Middle Eastern history and archaeology and adapted them for a popular audience, using titles like Did a Rolling Stone Close Jesus' Tomb? And What We Don't Know About Moses and the Exodus. Readers ranged from devout Jews to evangelical Christians. Many academics were mixed in. Shanks and the magazine's affiliated Biblical Archaeology Society also played an advocacy role in the field itself, especially in leading a successful campaign to free the Dead Sea Scrolls from the small circle of controlling scholars who limited access exclusively to themselves to those ancient Jewish religious manuscripts found in the Judean desert. Dead Sea Scrolls are crucial for understanding the development of both Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. In 1987, Herschel Shanks bought Moment magazine, the important bi-monthly magazine of Jewish ideas and opinions, founded 11 years earlier by past two Jewish guests Elie Wiesel and Leonard Fine. Shanks ran the magazine until 2004. Herschel Shanks was also the author or editor of over a dozen books on our biblical archaeology and other topics, and founded two other magazines, Bible Review and Archaeology Odyssey. A court in Warsaw ruled last week that two prominent Holocaust researchers must apologize to a woman who claims her deceased uncle was slandered in a historical work that suggested he helped kill Jews during World War II. Jan Grabowski and Barbara Engelking are widely respected historians with the Polish Center for Holocaust Research in Warsaw. They were the defendants. Lawyers for the woman, Filomeno Leszczynska, argued that he was a Polish hero who saved Jews, and the scholars harmed the good name of her and her family. The district court in Warsaw did not, however, rule that the scholars should be forced to pay her 100,000 zlotys, $27,000, as her lawyers had demanded. This ruling can be appealed and is not yet final. The case, reported extensively last week on Two Jewish, has been closely watched because it was expected to set an important precedent for independent Holocaust research. We will continue to follow this. A London court convicted a 16-year-old boy of terrorism. He researched producing weapons for what he described in online chats as actions to hang gays and gas Jews. The Central Criminal Court of England and Wales sentenced this teenager from Cornwall, 250 miles southwest of London, to 24 months at a youth rehabilitation program. He is the UK's youngest ever person to be convicted of terrorism. He pleaded guilty last week to 10 counts of possessing terrorist material and 2 counts of disseminating terror documents. His crimes began when he was 13. The teen was not named in the media as he remains a minor. Separately, Britain's Conservative Party dropped a local politician who referenced a Jewish lawmaker in a tweet about Aryans. The Conservative politician with the Tory party, Sharon Thomason, had been the party's choice for municipal elections in Warrington Borough, 180 miles northwest of London. Thomason wrote last year on Twitter, "Keep the Aryan race going," to Charlotte Nichols, a Jewish lawmaker for Labour. The tweet resurfaced this week ahead of elections, prompting the Conservatives to swiftly and immediately drop Thomason. And finally, the Iranian nuclear scientist assassinated near Tehran in November was killed by a one-ton gun smuggled into Iran in pieces by the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, according to a report last week in the Jewish Chronicle. Citing intelligence sources, the British Weekly said a team of more than 20 agents, including Israeli and Iranian nationals, carried out the ambush on scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh after 8 months of surveillance. The report was published on the website of the London-based newspaper, which is the oldest consistently published Jewish newspaper in the world. Iranian media said Fakhrizadeh died in hospital after armed assassins gunned him down in his car. Shortly after his death, Iran pointed the finger at Israel. Foreign Minister Javad Zarif writing on Twitter of serious indications of an Israeli role. Israeli government spokesman responded to the latest report by saying, "We never comment on such matters. There has been no change in our position." Fakhrizadeh, 59 years old, was long suspected by the West of masterminding a secret nuclear bomb program. He was described by Western and Israeli intelligence services as for years the mysterious leader of a covert atomic bomb program, halted back in 2003, which Israel and the United States accused Tehran of trying to restore. Iran has long denied seeking to weaponize nuclear energy. According to the Jewish Chronicles report, Iran secretly assessed that it would take 6 years before a replacement for this scientist is fully operational, and that his death had extended the period of time it will take Iran to achieve a bomb from about 3.5 months to 2 years. Giving no details on its sourcing, this oldest Jewish newspaper in the world said the Mossad mounted an automated gun on a Nissan pickup and that the, quote, bespoke weapon, operated remotely by agents on the ground as they observed the target, was so heavy because it included a bomb that destroyed the evidence after the killing. It said the attack was carried out by Israel alone, without American involvement, but U.S. officials were given some form of notice beforehand. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Melissa Zimmerman, is the Vice President of Clinical Services at Jewish Family and Children's Services of Southern Arizona, which offers all kinds of counseling services in a variety of ways, and certainly not just for Jews. How did Jewish ideas infuse the agency that you work with? Tell us a little bit about that.
Great question. You know, we've been around for about 80 years at this point, and we're really guided by Jewish values, which I think are kind of at the core of social work values as well. So, you know, the concept of Tikkun Olam and Chesed, you know, healing the world with loving kindness, is kind of what we root ourselves in. And we ensure everything that we're doing is kind of connected to those values. And that's where we started. As an organization, you know, JFCS has evolved so much over the years, working with people throughout the community. You know, at this point, we have our clinical department, we have our community services department, and we have our department for older adults and adults with disabilities. And throughout time, throughout the last 80 years, we've done a number of different things to help the community and kind of shaped things as we've gone along.
I want to talk a little bit about the kinds of cases you're seeing now. Has the pandemic changed that?
It has to some extent. You know, what we're seeing is really an exacerbation of symptoms. So people that would come to us with anxiety, depression, or people that we've worked with for quite some time with symptoms are really just worse because of all the other factors going on. So there's an increased need for therapy. And there's just less of those, there's less support for people in their home environment, their natural environment, which is often such a huge part of recovery. And so without those supports, you know, with increased isolation, it makes sense that people are feeling worse, that they're not getting better as quickly. So we've definitely seen an increase in urgency for services and an exacerbation of symptoms.
I wonder if there's not also a factor with people who are spending so much more time at home. I mean, not everybody works from home now, but sure a lot more. And I wonder, you know, isn't that kind of a pressure cooker in a way for families?
It can be. And I think that's what we're seeing, you know, over and over again is for some people it works great. You know, I've adjusted to working from home myself and being at home most of the time. But for many of the families we work with that have conflict, there is that decrease of access to the outside world. People use, other support networks as coping skills. They go outside, they do things in the community to get away from that environment periodically, which is so important. And without that outlet, you know, they really are stuck in a situation where they may not have the capacity to cope right now. What we've seen with the pandemic is there's all of these secondary consequences. And we've had necessary health and safety measures that we've had to follow to keep everyone safe. But, you know, there's secondary consequences like increased isolation. We've also seen an increase in economic stress. Many of our clients are presenting with more problems related to basic needs than have been in the past. So we're listening to stories more and more of people who are becoming homeless, are at the brink of homelessness, are struggling to have their basic needs met for themselves and their families. So all of those things combine, absolutely, it's a pressure cooker situation.
There's a concept in a different area called compassion fatigue. And I wondered if you would be willing to discuss that a little bit. People who are taking care of elder or homebound relatives or people who are ill, and particularly in this environment, there's not a lot of relief for that.
Sure. So compassion fatigue, the way that I usually explain it, is it's a combination of two things. It's a combination of burnout and vicarious trauma. So with burnout, Dr. Eric Gentry describes burnout as the chronic condition of perceived demands outweighing perceived resources. So no matter what you do, you feel like you just don't have enough in the tank to keep going and to meet all of your, you know, your needs. And the symptoms of burnout are anxiety, hopelessness. It can be caused by demanding and toxic environments, but I think what we're seeing now is just in general, a problem that we can't control and that continues to grow. So burnout is very high. The other part of compassion fatigue is vicarious trauma, which is sometimes referred to as secondary traumatic stress. And vicarious trauma is really the negative effects that are caused by your interaction with suffering and traumatized people. It can be caused by witnessing or interacting with traumatized individuals. And, you know, we're going through a collective traumatic experience right now. The entire world is. So it makes sense that more and more people are experiencing vicarious trauma, especially healthcare workers, you know, therapists, people who are working one-to-one with people who are going through these stresses and being affected on a daily basis. The symptoms of vicarious trauma are nearly identical to PTSD. They're gradual, they're cumulative. There's intrusive symptoms like nightmares, avoidance behaviors, hyperarousal. All of those things combine to make up compassion fatigue. One way of explaining it, one of my favorite quotes about compassion fatigue is Dr. Rachel Remen, who says, "The expectation that we can be immersed in suffering and loss daily and not be touched by it is as unrealistic as expecting to walk through water without getting wet."
That's a great description. What is hyperarousal? What does that mean?
That's a great question. Being hypervigilant, always on edge, not feeling like you can relax, kind of the smallest thing sets you off.
Right. So you're triggered easily by whatever the circumstance is, if you're caring for somebody. Or in a way, if everybody's going through, or so many people are going through this period of trauma, is that going to give us like some kind of PTSD afterwards?
You know, I think it's going to affect our mental health for the long run. I don't know that I would say it would give us PTSD, but I think the way in which we look at the world is going to change. You know, avoidance, which is a big symptom of PTSD, you know, avoiding situations that remind you of the trauma, avoiding people, places, I think that's going to come into play. I think there's going to be an increased fear of, you know, some of the things that we used to do. And it's going to shape the way we interact with each other moving forward.
I think people are going to get, if I could avoid Zoom after this, I'd feel really good about it.
Yes, I think Zoom fatigue is a separate piece of compassion fatigue, probably, definitely.
I'll tell you. I'm going to ask a different question. speaking as a rabbi and a teacher and teaching religious school kids, bar mitzvah kids, whatever, I will say, like, teaching younger kids online is really challenging. Is the same thing true with offering counseling services to younger children?
I would say it's definitely true. While some kids prefer it, I think many of our teens actually prefer it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But, you know, below the age of 10, it is tough. And we work with children as young as 2-3 years old. Uh-huh. And keeping them engaged over a screen is so difficult compared to, you know, being in an office where we have excellent play therapists who have all their cool toys that they can use. You know, we've had some kiddos that the therapist have told me, you know, after about 10 minutes, they're like, okay, bye-bye, and they wave bye, and they close the laptop.
And you're like, wait a minute, we're not done.
So, you know, it's definitely more challenging. And I think, you know, we look forward to the day that we can reopen for in-person services, especially for the young kiddos that are really struggling to keep engaged through the screen.
What's the most challenging thing, do you think, for therapists doing telehealth instead of meeting people in person?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer either. I think it's more difficult sometimes not being in the presence of your client. But honestly, right now, with everything that's going on, I think there's an increased sense of safety that we're able to provide this service, you know, even though we can't be in person. There are some therapists who love it, and there are some therapists who say, I can't wait to get back into the office. And the people who say that, you know, are struggling more without being in the physical presence of their client. Some of the therapies that we do are just, you know, more congruent with doing in person. They're more difficult to do over a screen. So we're having to adjust a lot. We try to have all of our therapists trained in EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization reprocessing therapy.
You're going to have to explain that. I'm sorry.
So it's a specific type of therapy for trauma, and involves, it's different than your basic talk therapy. So it involves some physical interaction in some ways. The client engages in bilateral stimulation while thinking about parts of their trauma. The easiest way of explaining it is it's an evidence-based method for trauma treatment, and it's something that a lot of people respond really positively to, especially people who aren't in the place to do talk therapy and just talk about their trauma over and over again. It's extremely effective, but it's one of those things that people are really used to doing in person. And when we first switched to telehealth, you know, my first thought was, well, we're not going to be able to do EMDR. That's going to be really tough. You know, but people have adapted. We were able to send a number of our therapists through a specific training for EMDR done through telehealth. So a lot of the things that I thought at first, oh, we won't be able to do that, you know, I've really been challenged in that thinking and seen that it is possible.
All right. How about a healthy question? What can people do to improve their mental health during what we hope are the last stages of this pandemic, although, of course, we don't really know?
Yeah. You know, it may be cliche, but building resilience is really my answer for that. And it's easier said than done, but there are different components. There are different things you can do to build your own resilience. Resilience is really defined as the ability to bounce back from a situation, an adverse event. And part of building resilience is self-care, which I think, you know, is a great buzzword these days, but it's really important to know that self-care is not just chocolate and bubble baths. Dr. Eric Gentry talks about
although those are good, let's be honest.
Those are very good, and they shouldn't be excluded. But it really, it goes beyond that. It goes beyond, you know, the fun stuff and really eating well and exercising and doing some of the less fun things that you know will improve your mental health and make you more resilient for the situation we're in. It also involves increasing your self-regulation, which means getting control of your body, being able to recognize when you're feeling triggered and when your sympathetic nervous system is a little bit out of control. So you're responding to things more negatively and quickly than you normally would. Self-regulation is really the process of learning what's going on in your body and how it's relating to your mental health. intentionality is another big piece of building resilience. Mindfulness, you know, I think of intentionality as moving in the direction of your goals and, you know, being able to say, am I moving towards the person I want to be in all of my actions? And when people are living in congruence with their values and their goals, they feel better. So that's an important thing. And then lastly, building connection and support is such a huge part of being resilient. And it's more challenging right now. You know, we're not getting together with friends as regularly or at all in many situations. Sometimes we can't see our family. So learning to build connection in different ways, whether that's, you know, creating a weekly Zoom, even though I know we're all tired of Zoom, creating a Zoom meeting each week for family or friends, that you're seeing people's faces, that you can check in with them. Those are all really important pieces, I think, in becoming more resilient so that we can withstand the crisis that we're in.
And speaking as a rabbi, I'm going to add, finding some spirituality in this time is also, I think, a good way to build resilience.
Absolutely.
I want to thank Melissa Zimmerman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Jewish Family and Children's Services?
So the best way is probably checking out our website, which is jfcstucson.org. You can learn more about the services that we offer, not only in the clinical department that I oversee, but our other departments, as well as our history, our mission, our values. That's the best place to go.
Melissa, thank you so much. And Mazel Tov on being a 40 under 40 leader for the future.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Gabriel Cousins, the physician, author, mystic, and rabbi who has just made Aliyah to Israel and has written a new spiritual autobiography called Into the Nothing. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Festival of Purim, a week from Thursday night and Friday. It's from the Maccabees, their parody of Jewish singer Pink's song Raise Your Glass, for Purim, appropriately. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Stand for a tale so grand. Shushan is the place where it all began. The hidden miracle. One man, second in command. Slay all the Jews with his wicked plan. A scheme so miserable. He chose a day for the disaster. It's ironic what came after. He didn't know a girl named Esther would turn it upside down. So raise your glass if you can see the hidden meaning. It's right in front of you. We will never be, never be anything but proud to tell the story. Then of a who.
Queen, cause God was pulling strings from behind the scenes. She wore the royal crown. 3 days the Jews just prayed. Queen Esther risked her life, went to save the day. She took Haman down. The streets were filled with celebration. Everyone ate Haman Tashin. Jubilation for the nation. Chanty Elamu.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.